The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Good evening. Welcome to tonight's book show. My first guest is Sid Moore, who grew up and lives in Essex, where the Essex Witch Museum mysteries are set. She's always had a lifelong fascination with witchcraft, and each of the books in her new series draws on real-life mysteries and historical events. Strange Fascination is the third in the series and out now. Also with us is Lee Russell, who's sold over a million crime fiction novels and has been nominated for several major awards. She also chairs the Crime Writers Association Debut Dagger Award, and her books have been optioned by major television production company Avalon. Her latest novel, The Adulterer's Wife, is perfect for fans of domestic noir. And lastly on tonight's show is Walt Pilcher. He's now retired from a long and successful career in commerce and broadcasting. His first full-length novel, Everybody Shrugged, was launched during International Trust Your Government Week. The book explores current global politics and brings to life a worldwide harmful substances race that threatens the sovereignty of nations. That's all on tonight's book show on Talk Radio Europe.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray. Presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Sid Moore, who grew up in and lives in Essex, where the Essex Witch Museum mysteries are set. She's the author of two previous novels, The Drowning Pool and Witch Hunt. A lecturer and a former presenter of Channel 4's book programme Pulp, she's the founding editor of Level 4, a magazine for arts and culture. Sid has had a lifelong fascination with witchcraft, and each of the books in her new series draws on real-life mysteries and historical events. The first two were Strange Magic and Strange Sight, and she's with us on the book show to talk about the third in the series, Strange Fascination. Welcome to the book show, Sid.
Hi, thank you very much for having me on.
It's a real pleasure to have you with us. Thanks for joining us. I love the tagline that says the third in a thrilling series about witches, magic and Essex girls.
That's right. And the first tagline as well for Strange Magic was brilliant as well. It was "The only way is witchcraft."
Oh, fabulous, fabulous, very clever. So where did your fascination of witchcraft come from?
Well, I've really, if I'm honest, I've always been quite interested in witches, even when I was a little girl, because my nan used to tell me fairy tales all the time, and I was much more interested in the witches than I was in the princesses, who sort of, to me, they just seemed to be quite passive. They'd wait around to get rescued or to get married by Prince Charming, whereas the witches, they had kind of agency, they were always doing things and flying around, and they had magic as well. And I was a bit of a tomboy, so I kind of liked that idea that they were out on their own, in the forest, in the woods, doing their own thing. And they just seemed more interesting to me, to be honest.
Yeah.
But then as I grew up as well, I started to uncover the historical truth of what happened to the witches. And I'm on radio now, but I am using my fingers to put imaginary inverted quotes around witches, because obviously most of the women who were actually tried and executed for witchcraft were completely innocent of the charges, and it was a great miscarriage of justice.
Yes. Are you talking about the Salem witch trials?
Well, no, I'm actually talking about the British witch trials, because we had lots and lots, and actually Essex had a huge amount. When I first started researching with conviction about 20 years ago, I had heard of, as I was growing up around me in the county of Essex, I discovered this really amazing statistic, which I'm going to just throw at you now because it is quite stunning. And that was between 1560 and 1680 in Kent, Hereford and Sussex, there were a total number of indictments for witchcraft. The total number was 185. But for the same period of time, Essex on its own had 503.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. So it's really quite staggering. So I started to dig down into these statistics because I was really shocked by it myself, having lived in Essex for most of my life, and also having, you know, feminist leanings and being interested in history. I was aware of Salem that you mentioned, where there was 19 deaths in over about 19 months. And I'd also heard of Pendle in Lancashire, which people like Jeanette Winston have written about as well.
Mm.
So in Pendle, it's quite a famous witch hunt, and there were 12 deaths there. But just on one day, I think it was 29th of July in 1645, 19 women were hanged in Chelmsford just on one day.
Goodness.
So as I looked further down, I came upon little blips. And one of them was this 1645 episode, which was the Matthew Hopkins witch hunt. I don't know if you've heard of him.
No.
He appointed himself as the witch finder general for England. And it was during the Civil War. And he really took advantage of the fact that a lot of the men in the villages in Essex and Suffolk were away fighting for Parliament or for the King. So there were a lot of women who had no protection. And interestingly, when I did look at all of these statistics about the Essex witches, I found out that a lot of them were obviously from a very low social class. A lot of them were called loose, which at the time meant they weren't under the protection or shelter of the man.
Okay.
And they were also called dumb because you had to have a man represent you at court. Women weren't allowed to speak for themselves, so they needed an uncle or a brother or a father or a cousin, anybody, basically, to speak for them. But, of course, with the Civil War going on, there weren't that many men around. So, and this was another thing that I started to look at and think about. It kept going around in my head, poor loose dumb, poor loose dumb. And then I thought, you know what, this sounds like a very contemporary stereotype that our ancestors got as well. And then I started to think, is it possible that the stereotype of the Essex girl has her roots in this deep, dark part of our past.
Isn't that amazing? All that way back as well.
Yeah. But if you think about it, you know, it's a stigma. And I just wondered, because we had so many women who were lost to the witch hunts, and Matthew Hopkins was terrible. He was a scourge, and he framed a lot of women. Most of them were innocent of all charges, but people believed in magic, and they believed in witchcraft, so they were hanged. But, you know, it is thought that he was responsible for between 300 and 450 deaths, because a lot of people didn't make it through the sort of the testing, which was torture, to the trials. They actually died before then. So he was a scourge. And during that time, Essex became known as Witch County.
Gosh.
And people said there's, you know, in Essex, you will find, always in a village, you will find at least one or two witches. And of course, this was the case. Matthew Hopkins was finding all these witches, but he was also getting paid for the amount of witches that he found. So he had a very interesting financial motive behind him. But then I kind of thought, well, you know, poor loose dumb. Is it possible that Essex, as it was known as Witch County, people started associating, yeah, there's something wrong with the women of Essex. And as the witch hunts faded from memory and as we, you know, ploughed on through the years, it was forgotten almost. But then in the 80s, when the Essex girl reared her big blonde flossy head, people went, oh, yes, that's right, there's something wrong with the women of Essex. That's what it is. It's a bit like when you're a kid and you're listening to your parents talk about funny Uncle Bob or something.
Yeah.
You can't quite hear them. But then when you grow up, you still have this notion there's something wrong with Uncle Bob. And it, could it be that that's sort of the same with the women of Essex, that they had this notoriety and then suddenly it was picked up again in the 80s with the stereotype of the Essex girl who was poor, loose and dumb.
Gosh, what an amazing connection. Yeah, I know you said a lot of these so-called witches were innocent, but what did people think they had done? What did it mean to be called a witch then?
Well, it's really, you know, it's a very, very complex subject, but there was a lot of poverty because the certainly in the Matthew Hopkins period, well, there was always a lot of poverty, to be honest, but in the Matthew Hopkins period, because the Civil War was going on, and people thought it was the end of the world because, of course, you know, the country was up in arms against the king, which was the world turned upside down. It had never happened before. People thought it was the end of times. So they were already on edge. But what would happen is a woman, usually poor, would quite often go begging to her neighbours for food. If she was refused food, then quite often she would curse that person, you know, a box on your house or something. Then if anything happened in that house, it would be blamed on her. She would have used witchcraft to cause it. So in Strange Magic, which is the first one in the Strange trilogy, the Strange series, I looked at a 1582 witch hunt in St. Osyth in Essex, and there was a woman called Ursula Kemp, and she was a healer, and she was also the midwife, but she was a very successful healer, and she's quite interesting because she was in the pamphlet that was written about the trial. She confesses that she did use magic. So she's very unusual in that most of the women accused of witchcraft said they didn't at all until they were tortured, really, and then confessed. But Ursula said that she used magic, and she was a successful healer. Now, her magic is really interesting because it had two parts to it. The first part is kind of really wacky. So you were meant to take a scoop of pig dung, mix it in with chervil, which is a kind of like chive-like herb, and then it gets a bit woo-woo. You have to get a knife, and then you have to stab under a wooden table three times whilst holding the mixture in your hand. Then you have to throw it all in the fire and wash your hands. But then, the second part, you then had to get 12 leaves of sage and 12 leaves of St. John's wort and mix it up with ale and then have that three times a day. So sage, we know, is really good for circulation. And St. John's wort, we now know, is like a herbal antidepressant. And, of course, ale, a lot of us tend to self-medicate with these days as well. So people were having this mixture three times a day, and they started to feel better. They started to, you know, feel the benefits of this. So she was seen as very successful. But then it was the whole thing. It was the pig dung and the knife and as well as the herbal remedy. And she also delivered babies. But the incident that sparked off her witch hunch was she actually wanted to deliver a baby from a woman who she had delivered her babies previously. Her name was Grace Thurlow. But Grace didn't contract her. And so Ursula burst in on her. Unfortunately, when she was in labour, Grace said, "Get out, get out. You are a nasty woman. Now, if anything happens to my baby, I know who to blame." So Ursula fled, and then the baby was born, and the baby was fine, but 3 months later, she fell out of her crib, finger of blame uncurled and pointed itself at Ursula, and the witch hunt began, basically.
So they just got blamed for anything?
Yes, I mean, in Essex, you know, there was a man walking down the road in one particular witch hunt, and some woman looked at him. He carried on walking down the road and about an hour later fell into a patch of brambles. And that was it. That was her fault. She looked at him funny. So, yes, and she ended up swinging for it as well.
So if you put a spin on it and look at it the other side, they're actually giving these women quite a lot of credit for the amount of power that they had.
Yes, exactly. And I think sometimes as well, you do read some confessions when it almost feels like the woman almost believes that she is a witch because she's things, and it's not such a big leap back then, because everybody did believe in witches, or a lot of people did. So it wasn't such a leap from witches exist to people accusing you of being a witch, and then you wondering, oh, maybe I did do that.
Yeah.
Maybe I am a witch. But unfortunately, there are a lot of tests. If you're accused of witchcraft, there are a lot of tests that you had to go through. And one was the swimming test, which a lot of people have heard of, where you had your right thumb tied to your left big toe, and then you were thrown into a pool of water. If you sank to the bottom, you were innocent of being a witch.
Oh, nice.
Probably, yes. But probably carked it, drowned. If you floated, then you were guilty and then taken out, and then you would be subjected to a few more tests. One of them was called watching, which sounds really, really gentle and very easy, but the accused would be tied on a small three-legged stool with the hands tied to the feet behind their back, and they would then be watched, but they would be watched for 3 days, 3 nights, like that. They wouldn't be given food, water. They would be kept awake. And of course, women's diet, it was so crippling. And if you can imagine what that was like, you could be uncut if you confessed that you were a witch. You could get relief. But also, if anything, while you were being watched, if a wasp or a bee or a mouse or a flea came into the room that you were in, that was your familiar, your demon spirit coming to help you in your hour of need. And so that also confirmed that you were a witch.
Gosh. It's horrendous, isn't it? I mean, it's really, really awful.
Yes. I mean, there was the idea of the devil's mark, which was also called the witch's mark. Certainly, was the Hopkins witch hunt. He brought this idea that if you were a witch, you had a spirit, a familiar, that would help you do your bidding. Now, because that spirit or familiar was demonic, you would make a connection. The witch would make a connection with it by feeding her own blood to it. So this would come out of part of the body, which was the witch's mark. But the witch's mark could be masqueraded. So it could masquerade as a blemish or a spot or a scar or a flea bite or a birthmark or a mole. But if you had flawless skin, you were fine. Any kind of blemish at all on your body, you could be accused of that being your witch's mark, your devil's mark. And then what the witchfinders did was they had a witch pricker. And the idea was that the devil's mark, the witch's mark, was demonic, so it didn't bleed. So you'd be pricked all over your body until they came to what they had decided was the devil's mark. And then you'd be pricked on the devil's mark, and if it didn't bleed, then this was a sign that it was inhuman and it was demonic, therefore you're a witch. But quite often we know from historical records and diagrams that were drawn at the time that the witch prickers actually had false handles. So you'd press you'd click a button and the blade would retract as you put it over whatever had been distinguished as the witch's mark.
Okay. God.
So, yes, we were really barbaric. And a lot of women died. Like I said as well, a lot of women died before they even got to court. So it's a really, really, really huge stain, certainly on the history of Essex. And that's kind of one thing that I'm really sort of wedded to doing with my books. Although my books are quite light and jolly and quite funny, I always want to remind people that, you know, I try to give this woman who was convicted and who was killed, really, murdered, I would say, I always like to try and give her a voice in my fiction, because so many of these women just slipped through the fingers of history and their voices have not ever been heard.
Yeah, that's awful. And is this Rosie Strange?
Yeah, so Rosie is the main character, the protagonist of the books, and I kind of wanted to create a character who didn't believe in magic, who was very sceptical. And also, the books open, she's a benefit fraud inspector working in Leytonstone, moved there from Essex. So I kind of wanted some element of the witchfinder about her as well. But she doesn't believe in anything. Then out of the blue, she inherits the Great Essex Witch Museum from an estranged relative. And she goes down to see it with a view to selling it up to a developer and taking the money and running off to Ibiza or something. But the museum exerts a curious pull over her, as does the curator Sam, who's really fit.
Oh, fabulous, we like Sam. Yeah. Well, so had you decided at the beginning that there was enough material to make a trilogy out of it? Was that the plan?
Absolutely, yeah. And I was recontracted last year as well for another three. So there's now six in the, there's going to be six in the series.
Oh, fantastic.
But again, if you look, you know, Essex, there's just so many stories, you know, there's so many witch myths that you can just scratch the surface on. You just find out a huge amount of stuff, which often makes you quite angry. But it's also, there are so many themes which are still very, very relevant today. So a lot of it is about scapegoating with the witches and bullying and intolerance. And of course, I always like to make the point that witch hunts aren't a thing of the past, unfortunately. Last year I was asked to be an ambassador for a Danish charity called Dinshub, and what they are set up to do is to create orphanages in Nigeria where children are often being accused of being witches and are cast out from their families, you know, as young as 18 months sometimes. Yeah, so, you know, in India as well, there's lots of women, older women. And in Kenya, women with dementia are often accused of being witches.
Oh, how awful.
Yeah, so it's still around us. You know, it's not confined to history. These things are still happening all the time. I think it's really important to remind people about that injustice, witch hunts still go on today in the world. Not just metaphorical ones, but real ones. So,
oh, I think it's brilliant that you've done these books. I've learnt so much just listening to you there, which I didn't know before, which is great.
You just wind me up and push me off and I will just talk about it non-stop. I hope it hasn't been too boring for you.
No, not at all. It's great. You're obviously passionate and very knowledgeable about it, so it's brilliant. If people want to get a copy of the latest book, it's called Strange Fascination, but I assume best that people start from the beginning with Strange Magic.
Yeah, of course, they're all absolutely fantastic. You will not regret it. The last one, is Strange Fascination. You can read each of them on their own, but to sort of get the character arc of Rosie and how she changes from unbeliever to something less than that, that's a really nice part of the story as well. But
okay.
I recommend all three.
So there's Strange Magic, followed by Strange Sight, and then Strange Fascination, all by Sid Moore, who we've been chatting to today. Sid, thank you so much for joining us. It's been great to chat with you.
Yeah, it's been wonderful. Thank you so much for having me.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
TRE. Online at tre.radio.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK, back on the book show, is Lee Russell, who's sold over a million crime fiction novels and writes full time. She's the best-selling author of the Geraldine Steele series. Her latest book is called The Adulterer's Wife. It's a suspenseful and gripping psychological thriller, perfect for fans of domestic noir. Welcome to the book show, Lee.
Thank you so much for inviting me along to have a chat with you.
Oh, no problem. Nice to have you back. How have you been?
Yeah, very good, very busy. We recently published the 10th in the Geraldine Steele series, and so the 11th has been edited. That's coming out in July. That's called Death Rope. I'm working on the 12th at the moment. There's edits for that coming in. So, things are going very, very well for Geraldine Steele, which is my best-selling series. That series has sold over a million copies.
Gosh.
And I've also, as you mentioned, I recently published a standalone, just as a one-off, which was a new departure for me because it's written in the first person, which is something I've never done before. And I think as a writer, when you have an established series, I'm now actually working on the 13th Geraldine Steele, doing the edits for the 12th. And so I find it's helpful to, once in a while, to write something completely different, just to challenge myself. And then when I come back to Geraldine Steele, it's like I've recharged my batteries a little bit, and I'm keen to get back to her. I think if I was only writing the Geraldine Steele series, then I might become a little bit slower with it.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. So how did you find writing this book then?
It was a challenge. I found it actually surprisingly easy because it was something so different, and because I wasn't writing it for publication and then it just got published, but I was writing it really more for fun. And writing the first person is a very different experience. When I write the Geraldine Steele series, they are written mainly from my detective's point of view, Geraldine, but I also write from my killer's points of view. What is going on there? What is driving these killers to act in the way that they do? That fascinates me. And I also write from the point of view of the victims and the people around the victims. So there are different threads going on in the stories. There tends to be a subplot. And it takes me 6 months to write a Geraldine Steele story with all the different threads running through it, the plot twists, and the research that I have to do. With The Adulterer's Wife, writing in the first person, there was one point of view. I just started at the beginning and wrote the story from one point of view. I didn't have to be quite so careful in a way with my research, because obviously with a police procedural with Geraldine Steele, when I'm writing from the point of view of a police detective, I have to get the procedures sounding authentic. Writing in first person, just by a member of the public, she could be blissfully ignorant of things and I could get away with it.
Yeah. In that respect, it must have been a lot easier then.
Yes, and just the one point of view as well. Yeah.
So tell us about Julie. Julie is the adulterer's wife.
Yes. And, I think the title tells you quite a lot, doesn't it? And all of my books really start with a what-if question. What would you do if this happened? And so with The Adulterer's Wife, it's what would you do if you discovered inadvertently that your husband was having an affair? Mm-hmm. And then while you're thinking about what you're going to do and dealing with your anger, what would you do if your husband was then murdered? And Julie becomes a suspect because she has told her friends that she knows her husband is having an affair, and then he's killed in their home. What would you do if that happened to you? And then the story spins out from there. I won't tell you any more. I'm not going to give any spoilers.
Yes. Oh, it's a great question. I like books like that that straight away make you think about what you would do in that situation.
Yes.
Those kind of moral dilemmas.
Yes, and I think because it's written in the first person, it perhaps forces the reader more than my other books in some ways to think, what would I do in that situation? But I think with the Geraldine Steele books, the what-if is slightly different, because it's also an examination of what would it be like to work as a detective working on murder cases. And Geraldine herself is never really fazed by seeing corpses. She somehow has always managed to sort of shut off, and she says somewhere that she sees the body as almost like a puzzle, a set of clues as to who killed this person. And she's very driven by a sense of justice for the voiceless dead. And so she wants to find out how this person was killed, who did it. Whereas her colleague, Ian Peterson, he struggles a little bit to cope with seeing dead bodies. And he avoids going to the scene of the crime when he can. And he's learnt to deal with that. But it has been a bit of a struggle for him. Very difficult if you're a detective working on murder cases, if you feel uneasy at the sight of dead bodies.
Mm.
And so Geraldine kind of questions her own responses, really. She thinks, is she a little bit inhumane that she doesn't feel upset by the sight of these bodies? She's more concerned with the living, the grief of the people who are left behind. That is what moves and disturbs her. The people who have lost a loved one in a sudden and violent way, not the sight of the dead body. So there's all sorts of questions that are raised for the reader, I think, in my police procedurals about, you know, how would you behave in this situation?
Mm.
But certainly writing the first person made it a much simpler story to write, and I wrote it actually very quickly. It takes me 6 months to write a Geraldine Steele story. The Adulterer's Wife I wrote in less than a month.
Wow.
Because I didn't have to do all the detailed research.
Yeah.
Didn't have to make sure that everything was right, because she could make mistakes, so
yeah.
I could get away with mistakes.
So has it made you want to write more?
Well, at the moment I'm very involved with Geraldine Steele. The 12th in the series is being edited at the moment, which is always a scary part of the process, waiting to hear what the editor will say. In fact, I was really pleased with Death Rope, the 11th in the series, which comes out in July, because my editor said, you know, after 10 books, you know, onto the 11th book, she said, "You never cease to surprise me. Well, how do you do it?" You know, I thought, wow, yes, that's great. Because one of the challenges of writing a series is keeping the stories fresh and keeping the reader on their toes and bringing in something new each time. So I'm working on the 13th story at the moment. I've got my idea in place. And I've signed to write another... I've signed to write up to number 16 in the series. I've just recently signed a four-book deal with my publisher. And then after that, I'm hoping we'll have another four-book deal, and that will take us up to 20 books in the series, which was always my ambition. I think because I read Cadfael when I was younger, and there are 20 books in that series, you know, Ellis Peters' wonderful series about her detective Cadfael. And so I've always aspired to write 20 books in the series. So that's very much in my head at the moment.
Yeah.
But at some point, I think... Yes, I mean, when I've finished writing the 13th book, when I have a little hiatus at some point, I think I might write another standalone. I've got an idea in mind. It's just when I have the time to do it. But there will be two Geraldine Steele books coming out in 2019 and another two in 2020. So I'm quite busy with those at the moment.
Yes, so, absolutely. And also you do a lot of work with the Crime Writers Association.
Yes, I'm on the board of the Crime Writers Association, and I'm also chair of the David Dagger Award, which is a very, very rewarding thing to do, because the Crime Writers Association, it does celebrate the very best in crime writing, but it also supports and encourages emerging new talents, and this is what the David Dagger does. It's a very prestigious award, and the winners and most of the shortlisted authors for the past few years when I've been involved in it have all gone on to gain publishing deals. So it is an entry path into publication if you can win it or be on the shortlist. So yes, and it's very interesting reading the entries. Very, very difficult to judge them, to pick a winner, because they're all so excellent in their own way. But
yeah,
we do have a panel of judges, so it's not just down to me. We have a panel including an acquiring editor for one of the big publishers, including a top literary agent, myself, and a couple of other agents. So it's a very carefully considered decision.
It must be very difficult for writers to come up with something new. You know, there's lots of crime thrillers out there or psychological thrillers, and they're obviously very, very popular books, very popular subjects. Is it difficult to think of a story without thinking, no, I'm sure I've read a book like this before?
Oh, I know. I mean, everything's been done, hasn't it? And, I mean, Shakespeare didn't have this problem, did he? I think only two of his plays were original stories. It's what he did with them. So I think, yes, it may be that you hit on an idea that somebody else has worked on before, but you will deal with it in your own individual way.
Yeah.
And so it's what you do with the idea. But, yes, it is very difficult. And the thing I find the most difficult, really, is writing something and... finding a twist that readers don't see coming, because my readers, most of them are very sophisticated in the genre. They read far more books than I have time to read now, and I'll put in a little misdirection or a red herring, and the readers will think, oh, okay, there's a misdirection, and I try and put in a little twist, and they think, yep, saw that coming. So in some of my books, I do manage it. I do manage to include a twist that nobody sees coming. Very often readers do see them coming, and they still enjoy the books, so I think they enjoy the feeling of, yes, I knew that was going to happen. But I do my best to surprise my readers, but what I won't do is put in a twist that you couldn't possibly have foreseen, because I think that's cheating. So all the clues have to be there in the book. And my aim is that when my readers get to the end of the book, they think, oh, yeah, of course, why didn't I see that coming?
Yeah.
But very often they do see it coming, which, you know, I'm sorry about that, but it's very difficult to stay one step ahead of highly intelligent people who are looking for the twists and the tricks.
Definitely. Well, if people want to get a copy of The Adulterer's Wife, it is out now by Lee Russell, who we've been chatting to. People can get a copy of it on the TRE bookshop section of our website.
Fantastic.
Lee, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much indeed. It's been a pleasure.
The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray. TRE, your voice in Spain. The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the States is Walt Pilcher, who's now retired from a long and successful career in commerce and broadcasting. He's with us on the Book Show to talk about his first full-length novel, launched during International Trust Your Government Week. It's called Everybody Shrugged. Welcome to the Book Show, Walt.
Thank you very much, Hannah.
A pleasure. Thanks very much for joining us. So tell me a bit about your broadcasting career, can you?
Well, mostly it took place in college, although I guess it started in high school with having been influenced by the likes of Bob and Ray. I don't know if those are familiar names to your audience, but they had radio shows here in the States where they just did parodies of everything. And so my friends and I would get on our little tape recorder and make up our own parodies. And that carried over into college, where I volunteered to be on the college radio station, which, when we first got there, was just a little closed-circuit thing. But then we went to FM and went big time while I was there. And we had a radio program called To Be Announced, because we could never figure out what the right title should be. Partner and I would put on sketches. There was once an eclipse of the moon, so we recreated that right there in the studio. I volunteered to be eclipsed, and my partner was the narrator. So things like that.
Oh, great fun! Was it fun?
Oh, it was a lot of fun.
Yeah. And how about your marketing career?
Well, that was interesting too. I started off with a company that made baby food. I worked on a product called MetriCal, which was a dietary product that some of your listeners may have heard of as well some time ago. But where I ended up was in the pantyhose business, or I guess you call them tights, and became the marketing vice president and eventually the president of a company called Legs, and that's the pantyhose and the plastic eggs, again, which many people might remember. Never did much with that overseas, but here in the States it was the largest brand.
Yeah. So how did you come to write this book then?
Well, I guess I've been writing since I was age 11, starting off with commercials for Mother Murphy's Moldy Meatballs and the like. I've always been interested in satire, somehow influenced by the likes of James Thurber and Robert Benchley and later Woody Allen and so forth. But satire was my forte. And even in business writing, I would write the occasional false fake memo. For example, one year the nylon crop failed. Well, everybody knows nylon is not a crop, it's a chemical, but I turned it into a crop and wrote a memo that I circulated around the company talking about how there might be a shortage of pantyhose and prices might go up and that sort of thing. So satire was fun. And I've always had a kind of a love-hate relationship with authority. I respect authority, but I believe we should always question it, especially if it's the government.
Mm.
So at the time I started writing this novel, which was some years ago, the government seemed to be interested in finding things that were harmful to your health and wanting to outlaw stuff like or limit or tax things like alcohol, caffeine, chemicals in makeup, And then, you know, eggs are bad, and now eggs are good, and now eggs are bad again. We're going to limit all that. So it just struck me that there might be a way to write something about what happens if you take this impetus by the government to control everything, particularly things that are fun to do, including, you know, tight underwear, sexy underwear, hot dogs, you name it, and ban all of it, and including banning weapons, weapons of mass destruction, weapons of war. So I set up this situation where the government is banning all this stuff, including the weapons of war, and so the Army doesn't have anything to do. The government has turned over the defense of the country to countries like Peru and Honduras, and yet there's still this group of retired generals in the Army who somehow still have offices in the Pentagon that they come in 2 or 3 days a week, and they say, no, our mission is still to protect the country. So while all this research is going on, sponsored by the government, to identify and outlaw harmful substances, these generals set up a command called MADCOM, and it's designed to steal the harmful substance research and turn it into weapons, turn the harmful substance into weapons. So you've got these two things playing against each other, the Army trying to weaponize the research and the researchers trying to come up with more and more things to ban, and it all comes together with a crash in the novel.
So when you're saying making weapons out of the harmful things, you mean things like bacon and butter and coffee and beer and that kind of thing?
That's right. imagine a tobacco bomb. putting large amounts of caffeine in the enemy's water supply so that they go crazy. Ridiculous things like that.
Yeah, fantastic. I love it. So tell me about your main character.
Well, I really have two main characters, and that's one reason I think that I had so much trouble finding a publisher for the book, and only the great folks at Fantastic Books Publishing saw the potential for this thing. The one first main character is a guy named Major Tony Farina. He's a Vietnam veteran. He was involved in a questionable activity in Vietnam involving a combat incident that went wrong. Nobody really got hurt, but it was one of those things that the Army had to cover up by promoting him, which happens quite a lot. But he's the one that these generals decide to put in command of the MADCOM thing to steal the research and weaponize the harmful substances. The other main character is a guy named Dr. Gardy Lavager, who is a university professor who is a fanatic about finding these harmful substances, and he and his assistant George Smith have a laboratory at a university in Southern California, and they determine what's harmful, and they run off to Congress, and Congress bans whatever it is. The main way that they determine what's harmful is they feed stuff to rats, and if the rats die, then it must be harmful. So if you can imagine, for example, colored crepe paper, if you feed a lot of colored crepe paper to a bunch of rats and they die, then that crepe paper must be outlawed. So, again, we have the absurdity of all this. And these two characters who don't know each other at the beginning of the novel working at cross purposes until they finally do intersect in a way that would be a spoiler if I gave it away.
Oh, yes, don't give it away. So where does the title Everybody Shrugged come from?
I guess I have to give a nod to Ayn Rand from Atlas Shrugged. Now, her novels her novel was much more serious than this, but it really had to do with government overreach. And I thought that while there were some responsible people in that novel, my novel would be one where actually nobody's responsible and nobody's actually normal and everybody's actually nuts. And so Everybody Shrugged made sense.
Yes, I like it. And I'm surprised that there is such a thing as International Trust Your Government Week, suggesting that we shouldn't do that anyway. Do you know what I mean? The fact that there's a day about it, reminding people that we should trust our government, is an odd thing, don't you think?
Well, I would have thought it was odd before I made it up.
Oh! That's funny. Okay, I didn't realise that. I was going to say, that's a really odd thing.
Ben Grubb, the publisher over at Fantastic Books, said, you know, we really ought to launch this in connection with some sort of a holiday that makes sense. So I went online and looked up all these holidays, and there are a bunch of ridiculous ones as well as legitimate ones. And I couldn't find one that made sense, so I just made it up, and he liked it, so we went with it.
Oh, brilliant. I like it even more. So I'm assuming that your general sort of consensus is that we shouldn't be trusting our governments. You're challenging them all the time, are you?
I think that's what we should be doing, and it doesn't really matter which political party is in power. I have my leanings, of course, as most of us do, one way or the other, but it really doesn't matter. I think they should be questioned at all times and challenged.
It's surprising how many people don't, isn't it?
I guess you're right. It probably is surprising. But what's going on now, of course, is that everybody seems to be challenging everything. So it's I really don't know what to make of all that.
Yes, it's in the States, you mean?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, no, people do. And around the world, more so than ever before, perhaps, looking at the States and one particular country. I don't think the rest of the world and Europe have had much or as much interest in American politics as they have done in the last year or so.
Well, I'm sure that's true, and I think that we may even be seeing some fallout from some of what's going on here over there. For example, the Brexit vote.
Yeah.
Strikes me as being something that might have been somehow informed by what's going on here.
That's interesting. Well, have you enjoyed writing this book?
Oh, very much so. It's a lot of fun.
And do you think there'll be more?
Oh, yeah. In fact, there is already one more that the Fantastic Books people are looking at. They haven't made a decision about it, but I'm hoping that they'll buy it.
Oh, great stuff. Well, good luck with that. In the meantime, if people want to get a copy of Everybody Shrugged, it's available to buy in the TRE bookshop section on our website, tre.radio. It's by Walt Pilcher, who we've been chatting to today. Walt, thank you very much for joining us.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray. TRE.